You may kill me, but you may never insult me. Who am I? Captain Jack Sparrow.
Get the truth about movies on the movie show.
If he were telling the truth, he wouldn't have told us.
Tell them, Sparrow.
Unless, of course, he knew you wouldn't believe the truth, even if he told it to you.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Joey, it's Ross. I need some help.
Help has come your way because you are listening to the movie show.
What is up?
Hello.
This is the movie show.
On
Active FM. Ryan, you know that's normally your thing, right? Your favorite ORSPS.
My name's Ryan.
Mansesh.
Yes. And welcome to another hateful movie show.
No. Funny, though, there was often in watching this film that I literally was like, I hate this movie.
Really? The first part of the film until the killing spree at the end, I loved. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
There were moments that I loved it. There were moments that I hated it. And then after doing research, I completely have so much respect for this film. I'm so confused. I feel like Quentin Tarantino is the only person who can achieve.
This movie had me glued in. And then at the end, when all, because the first thing I thought was like, okay, there's not much swearing. This is great. I'm enjoying this. There's not much this. This is good. There's not much that. This is fantastic. Each character is like brilliant. I love it. And then at the end, like the tension hypes, everybody's emotions hype, and then the swearing comes out, the gore comes out, the blood. And they're even laughing while they're hanging the
ladder. Yeah, like, can I actually say the gore got to me? I think this was the...
That's what I'm saying.
This was the first time I was actually like, okay, no, this is a little bit too... For me, it was when that guy, Channing Tatum's character, is shot and...
Yeah, from there.
He goes... So, his sister has... She's the only... Well, not the only female, but she's like the main... She's the prisoner, the whole film.
Yeah.
And then at one point, he's trying to save her, but then he gets shot in the head by Samuel L. Jackson, I think.
I would also shoot him.
But literally, his brains and every... He go all over her. And like, she screams because now she's covered in her brother's insides.
But you know what? Yeah, his brains. Like, she's had such bad luck with stuff all over her.
Yeah, shame.
I mean, she got vomited on. At that point, I'm like, she's also going to get poisoned now, but she didn't. So, Quentin's idea of this movie, which matched, I was just like, okay, that makes... I think his idea worked well, and it's what... Because, number one, this movie, the length of it, the tension, like there wasn't a lot of quick shots and action, but the characters build so much tension. So a guy with a bad attitude shows up in a situation, and then there are four mysterious guys that nobody knows, and everyone is a suspect, and you can't trust anyone. At the end of this film, there's no hero and there's no moral center.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's a perfect description.
That was his description of the film. And the fact that you didn't know who anybody was, you couldn't trust nobody. I'm like, everyone's a suspect.
It was a murder mystery. I feel like at one point I was like, okay, no, we're on the murder mystery vibe type of thing.
Yeah.
So I like, it was a, this movie was not like any other Quentin Tarantino movie that I've watched. Honestly, it stands alone by itself. There's like different emotions.
You're like, okay.
And can I, except it is, I'd say the film it's most similar to out of Quentin Tarantino's is Reservoir Dogs, which was his first film. It's got the most similarities to that film as opposed to a Quentin Tarantino film. Because the reason I say that is, so, first of all, Quentin Tarantino did say there were two movies that he got inspiration from for this movie. The first movie was The Thing, which was a sci-fi horror, where Kurt Russell was actually in The Thing. And it was the only movie that Quentin Tarantino showed the cast. But the second movie that he was inspired by was Reservoir Dogs. Mm. And I know that you could argue, but a director can't be inspired by his own movie to when making another. But he really was, and for me, I got it.
It's the same pace. Yes, it's the same dialogue, yes. Long shots.
Plus, it takes place in like one location. Mm. The film takes place in whole, obviously it starts off with them on the road, which Reservoir Dogs was sort of the same. It started at the diner.
The main event is outside of the timeline of the film.
Yes.
Like what everybody did.
Yes. And then it's now just about these characters that are stuck together. Circumstances have caused them to be stuck together for a long period of time. But at the same time, the film's events, obviously there's a flashback involved, but the film's events take place in the span of a day. It's not a 2 week length story. It's literally like what happened in a day.
It's not even a complete day. It's more like an afternoon into evening.
Into evening, yeah.
You don't know how late it went, but most probably by midnight. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which Reservoir Dogs was the same.
Yeah.
So plus the other reason I say that was Reservoir Dogs. This is a spoiler. So spoiler alert. Reservoir Dogs ends with every single character that you meet in the film dying. Actually, no, not every. So Reservoir Dogs was slightly different. There was like the cop friend that didn't die. But in this film, think about it, Ryan. Every character that you meet in The Hateful Eight dies.
Well, we don't know about the last two. You can't say for sure.
They were like lying there
for me,
preparing to die.
For me, that's the... You know, in every one of Quentin's films, there's a mystery. Like, did so-and-so always, you know, with this? Because they could have.
But wait.
Medically, probably so, but you don't know. You can't say for
long,
sure.
How long can you survive with a gunshot wound bleeding out?
But what if somebody stopped by there?
There was a blizzard. And who?
Are you saying it's impossible that somebody could have come?
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying impossible.
A blizzard like that. Well, think about it. Remember Obi, the carriage driver, goes out. He has to throw the guns down the wall or whatever. He literally went out for like, what was it, 5 minutes max. And by the time he gets back, he's almost frozen to death. And he's even mad at them and says to them, I almost died doing that.
So the possibilities are very, very slim. What if the gunshot wound in the sheriff's leg, maybe there was a medic kit. You don't know. Leaving someone alive. Come on. Let's look at horror films. Usually it's like, you know that line, you should have killed me. Mm. You should have made sure I was there. I mean, come on, Thor. I mean, not Thor, Thanos. You should have gone for the head, you know? It's that thing of, as long as he's alive, he's still alive. And you never know what's going to happen. That's us. I'm like, okay, so did they make it? Did they... You like left them there still. They didn't like.
Okay, if it's Marvel and there's green and purple men walking around, no, they didn't die. If it's reality and there's a blizzard outside and they say we're stuck here for the next 2 to 3, 4, 5 days, depending on how long the snow stays in, and it's not modern times. It's back way then when the medical. You know, and these two guys are bleeding to death and not doing anything about it. They're lying on a bed smiling about a letter, a fake letter from Abraham Lincoln.
No, not even the letter. It's the woman hanging.
No. But after the woman gets hung, they laugh about how Samuel L. Jackson's character wrote a fake letter from Abraham Lincoln. I think they died personally. Just my personal opinion.
There's a big percentage that they did.
Yeah, very big.
But there's still a percentage that they didn't.
But that we'll never know. That's just one of those that things that Quentin, Quentin can literally leave people arguing about something that we will never know.
So I watched the channel. Yes, I did. I watched the channel. That's the right way to put it.
The whole channel.
I'm correct. There was a channel on YouTube. Yes. Where it was, things wrong with,
The Hateful Eight.
With The Hateful Eight. And basically at the end, he summed up and he said, so the next people to stumble across, this stop will stumble upon hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of corpses.
Yeah.
Lucky them. Hopefully they don't, try to drink out the well.
Or the coffee.
Oh, yes. It's the coffee. Oh, my word. Yeah, but
I also also had that thought though, what would happen if you arrived at like, cause it was a haberdashery.
Who knows?
You arrive at a haberdashery and there's literally, how many corpses were there? Yeah. There were more than eight, cause there were eight people that all ended up, okay, there's two people that might still be alive, but six other people definitely dead, plus there's people in the well that are dead, which was like four people, what, or.
Yeah. I mean, we don't think about that when it comes to wells, do we? We just like drink out the well. We're just like, nah, it's fine.
I don't think I've ever drunk out a well.
Is it?
You've drunk out a well?
No. Well, I've had well. Bore water before. Yeah, that's very similar.
Okay.
I think it's very similar. Although, I mean, I suppose the whole. But I mean, who else is drinking out that water? Who else is connected? Anyway, that's a deep.
That's why
right
you boil
there.
Your water before you drink it, people.
Always boil your water.
Always boil your water.
But this channel picked up 84 things which made sense. But anyway,
84 things wrong.
84 things that didn't actually make sense.
Oh, really?
But I don't think that's the highlight. Like, obviously, there's going to be missed stuff.
Every film's
going to. If you really want to get sticky about stuff.
Yeah.
And then he picked up the N word was used 59 times in that film.
And that was referring to, okay, mainly Samuel L. Jackson.
It was quite hilarious because what he did is he literally cut out, he played through all the parts where a lot of the word was used, and then he muted it and put another word there. So, for example, doctor, hamster. And you'll say, where a big pile of hamsters were found. And so it was quite funny.
Wow. So, do you know that the script for this film leaked online before they made it? And so Quentin didn't actually want to go through with making it. Instead, he said he was going to adapt it and just release it as a novel. But then there was a brief reading in LA and the cast was stunned and got so excited for the film. And then Samuel L. Jackson persuaded Quentin to actually go ahead and make this film.
Go, Samuel.
Yeah. So that was.
He was like on another level.
He was.
Because especially the fact that Quentin described him as a guy with a bad attitude because.
Oh, was he the guy with a bad attitude?
Yeah.
Oh, he was. I was thinking Kurt Russell.
You think, okay, you can trust him.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson was actually just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like out of all of the, like Kurt Russell's character had, there was direction. Like he was taking this chick to, what was it? Red Rocks to be hung. All the other guys, they were actually gang members just, you know, trying to
and
save
they were
her.
All in it. All, except for Shame.
And then
that
also,
old guy, the old colonel, whatever.
Yeah,
that
the old
colonel.
They just, that was like pure coincidence. Mm. Like, and then Samuel L. Jackson just happened to be stuck in a blizzard at the wrong time with the wrong group. And then ended up possibly dying because of it.
Possibly dying. Yeah. So like I said, the film had me, and then when the shooting, when the end part happened where a lot of people die, I was just like, okay. Even that one scene where Samuel Jackson describes what he did with that colonel's son.
I hated that scene.
The problem is, it was very visual.
You couldn't get more visual.
And even if you turned your eye away and you just listened to what he said, it was extremely, yeah. So I was just like, I think from there I was just like, okay. And then like the end part, I was just like, and then I had to go to bed after this. I had to close my eyes and go sleep. I think I stayed awake for about half an hour after that, just trying to think of
happy thoughts.
Yeah, because it was that Quentin Tarantino, you know, just the blood and the way.
Which is exactly how Reservoir Dogs left you. You were just like,
the worst is when they're laughing or they're hanging their head. They're like, it was like such a pleasure for them to die.
I think that is one of the things that's disturbing about.
And the camera was on a close up on her for quite a while while she's like,
yeah, she's like,
and I'm just like. It was very good how they got it to, you know,
her teeth.
The makeup, because the one part, like her teeth got, the front teeth get, and they weren't broken out. They weren't knocked out. Like
they were the half.
They were broken. I was just like.
Can I just say, she starts off having a black eye, like a black eye. Like she,
and the minute you see it, you're like, ooh, what's going on here?
And she's got this like black eye. And I was watching an interview. So the person who played, her name was Daisy in the film, is Jennifer Lee. So she said that on the first day of shoots, obviously she's got this black eye. So she takes a selfie of herself and sends it to her mom and literally said to her mom, this is as good as it gets. Because as the film progresses, she's literally just covered in blood. By the end of the movie, she's
vomit.
just There's blood, vomit, blood, her teeth brains, are knocked out. She's got her brother's brains on her. Like, her foot gets shot. Like, by the end of the film, like, the interviewer is still saying, like, he respects actresses who are willing to go into a film without makeup. Like, where there's, like, a natural, you're not being, like, prettied up or anything like that. Like, he respects that. But now for her, like, she went, like, 10 steps above that, where it wasn't just, you know, no makeup, like, natural. It was, like, super bloody and like black eye and like just gore and like imagine being on set every day with that, like, yeah, no, it was very intense. One thing that also stood out, I must say, so as much as I didn't, this is the problem with this movie, I didn't like it. I didn't like this film. I would say it's from a storyline perspective, it's lower on the list of my favorite Quentin Tarantino films. And I realized one of the things that I enjoy about movies is a redemptive arc. That's one of the reasons. So if I look at all of my top movies, often there's a redemptive arc with the character. The reason I probably don't like this type of film is because there's no redemptive arc.
So in other words, you're saying, what if the two did survive? They didn't hang her. They took her to Red Rock to meet her fate. Because all the gangs are, even the hangman, he was like quite cruel, actually.
I like, Kurt Russell's character was.
He was cool. Kurt Russell's got a very...
Kurt Russell's a brilliant actor.
He's got a very distinctive type of character that he plays. It's very strong.
But all of the actors were strong in this. Like, there's
Samuel Jackson is like on another level.
That's why I respect Quentin Tarantino though as a director, because I honestly feel like he pulls performances out of people. So like I've said this before, Samuel L. Jackson is a good actor, and you watch him in like other movies and he's good, you know, he's an actor. But then you watch him in a Quentin Tarantino movie and it's like a performance like you've never seen before. For me, Brad Pitt's greatest performances are always in Quentin Tarantino movies. Even Leonardo DiCaprio is a good, he's a good actor, he's very good, and I enjoyed him also in like a Baz Luhrmann film, like he's good. But I don't know if you remember his character in Django, like the acting,
you didn't even really recognize, you actually forgot that it was Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's the thing,
both in Once Upon a Time and also in Django.
And for me, when you forget that a person is acting, that's when they've really like mastered the craft. Really, do you understand what I'm saying? Because now you're not thinking I'm watching a film. You've been pulled in so much. And I have to say, this film is good from the perspective of it, the feeling, the emotion it evoked in me. So the fact that it got, do you understand what I'm saying? For me, when a film is able to evoke certain emotions within you.
I was glued, eh?
That's the thing.
And then at the end of it, you're just like, oh no, this is a mess. This is a bloody mess.
Then excuse the pun.
I was just like,
talking about blood, do you know that Quentin Tarantino invented his own blood?
Like his own recipe.
His own, he has a recipe for blood, because obviously he often uses like a huge amount.
More brown.
Yes, there's a certain color of red, plus the texture itself, and obviously the way it like spurts and splatters around. But there's literally, and also the amount, obviously.
The amount of blood told me that those two guys have a high possibility of not surviving, because they were like all over their hands. And even when Samuel Jackson was moving in the bed, you could hear how much he had bled and how he's just,
See, right, I told you, those two ain't surviving. Yeah. But he literally invented his own blood. But back to the soundtrack. So do you know that the guy that did the soundtrack, the music for this movie, did the music for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? That's how far back he goes. So he's a very big Western, specifically like Western movie soundtracks. Mm. He's done a lot of it. He also did the soundtrack for Django. For his name's Ennio Morricone, something that's probably not how you pronounce his name. But anyway, so he's a composer. And he actually was quoted as saying that he will never work with Quentin Tarantino again after how his music was handled in Django. But then he changed his mind and agreed to score The Hateful Eight. And then he said in an interview that he accepted Quentin Tarantino's request to score the film because he liked the script. I'm like, what? how, what, but anyway, and because Tarantino gave him full freedom in the composition, he also said that he considers the film an adventure movie rather than a Western, and as a result, he tried to make the music sound completely different from his famous Western scores, and he based the music on the feelings that the script evoked in him rather than composing music for specific scenes. Because he only had a month to produce his score, he added several pieces of music that he had originally written for The Thing, so he'd also composed the music for The Thing, which is a film from 1982, and then some of which had never been used. He then finally gave Tarantino 5 pieces of music which he could use in the movie as he pleased.
Okay.
So that's
how they worked.
Yeah, that's how they worked it. Right.
So it wasn't specifically written like, okay, here's the scene, and then they play it, and then he matches it. It was just... from reading the script, how he felt.
But I don't think Quentin works like that, because if you look at his previous films, most of his films didn't have original scores. They were previous, he mainly sourced music,
songs, yes.
And would then,
that's true.
Only have a few cues. So he'd have the that was obviously an original thing for like Kill Bill. But like most of the music, he often will play like an old 60s song or get an old band or band that does old 60
some
songs
pop song.
So he doesn't, most of his films don't have an original score. Like if you listen to music, you can't go, oh yeah, that was the theme of that. You don't have the theme of, whereas this film, there was that very, the song that starts the film, that one had like a very distinct sound to it. And then it would come back. And I think it was used to end the film. And honestly, that piece of music is the perfect piece of music for this movie, because it's like, there's like, something's coming. It's not good. There's like sinister underlying tones. You like, there's lots of different characters within it.
Really helps set the suspicion.
No, it really did. Like it was, for me, the music was really good.
And then he gets away with a 5-minute credit of like, landscapes and.
Yeah.
You just like, okay.
Mm-hmm. That was the other thing that was different was the setting, the snow landscapes. And I know that watching, like some of the producers and that, they said it wasn't easy to film in, but the crew really got together and like really did the best, because they were literally filming in snowy conditions. And at some points, normally they filmed in Colorado, and normally the weather there is quite bad. But then for them, they start filming and what happens? It stops snowing, right? Because that always happens, need it to snow when filming. So they actually had to like halt production, and they had a 5-day shoot. So out of 7 days in a week, they would shoot for 5 days, but it got to the point where literally they needed it to snow. And if it started snowing on Saturday or Sunday, it didn't matter if it was Saturday and Sunday. They literally pulled everyone together and filmed because they really needed the snow. And I mean, the whole film is set in a blizzard, a snow blizzard. So like the snow was really important.
And those would have been a lot of the exterior scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was hectic.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at behind the scenes footage, like it's snowing.
The majority of it was inside.
Yeah.
I love the part as well where they were like, now the door. Everyone's like, no. You have to put 2 planks of wood. Two planks. Get 2 planks.
And everyone's shouting it at the same time.
Exactly. Kick it in. And then at the end, you understand why the door, the thing doesn't work. It's
But then also the cast and crew worked in a refrigerated set. So obviously outside, they were outside. But when they were working in the cabin, you'll see there was the cabin and then the windows had blue screen on them. So obviously all of the exterior shots were, well, as in from the inside the cabin, that was just blue screen. But they were in a refrigerated set and the temperature was 30 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1 degree Celsius. Imagine working in a, I'd die. I'd be done. I'd just be like, guys, can I please be fired? Like, I love y'all, but when it's warmer, just call me, I don't think I'd survive a 1 degree set every single day for 5 months, because that's how long they shot for. 5 months!
There's
That's longer than winter.
There's a part in the film where Odie, right? Mm. Odie walks in. No. And then he's like,
Obi.
Yeah, I'm not going out there. And then he still pulls a blanket off.
He just lies by the fire.
And then he snuggles up to the fire like that.
Do you want something to eat? Not now.
He's like a dog. He's like,
And he even looked like frozen. Like he looked like there was a layer of ice over him.
But his whole reaction. He's like, would you like some stew? He's like, no thanks.
Later.
Warm now. You know, type of thing.
And then I don't know if you noticed, because there was like, that's what I also respect about Quentin Tarantino and actors that work with Quentin Tarantino is oftentimes with the movie, it's like, okay, close up. All right. And cry. Cut. Done. Whereas with Quentin Tarantino, it's, there's a 10-minute dialogue scene and the camera stays on you for 10 minutes and you're in the background lying by the fire. I don't know if you picked that up. And then at some certain point in the conversation, you know, now you have to stand up and then you stand up in the background. Cause did you see him stand up in the background?
I actually didn't.
It makes you feel like you're not watching a movie. It makes you feel like, do you understand what I'm saying? Obviously, with Quentin,
Like Bob playing the piano.
Yes.
Like, you could actually hear him
playing the
piano. Starting again, then adding on. And you could even hear him going, ugh.
Yes, in the background. Again. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like really realistic. Mm. And then there are subtle references to Django in this film.
Yeah.
Firstly, when Major Warren is introduced, he's sitting on top of three corpses. That was Samuel L. Jackson's character, and a saddle that was previously owned by Django, so the exact saddle. The second is Django's green colored jacket is seen on the floor in Minnie's haberdashery, and both of these references have been confirmed by Samuel L. Jackson. And third, Walton Goggins' character is called a hillbilly. He was the sheriff in both films because he was also in Django. And the fact that, in fact, this film was going to be a sequel to Django.
Right.
But then Quentin scrapped that idea and he didn't say this while doing press because he didn't want people to, because there was a lot of speculation that this was a sequel to Django, but he then later explained that in the earliest concepts of the story, it was a sequel to Django, and that Samuel L. Jackson's character, I think, was supposed to be Django himself. But then he also started it, he wanted to call it Django in White Hell, which I don't know if you saw in the last chapter.
The one chapter.
It was, I think a black man in White Hell, obviously referring to Samuel L. Jackson. However, he didn't get that far with the novel because he realized that it didn't work to have a character whose morals were known to the audience beforehand, being in Django, nor a character you felt was fairly sure to survive. So he obviously didn't want to kill Django's character after, you know, Django survived Django. And then he withheld this trivia, though, from interviews until after the film's release because he was already contesting false reports that the movie would be a sequel to Django and didn't want further muddle earlier basically, he didn't want the public to expect a sequel and then go and watch it and then be disappointed because now it's not a sequel. So he obviously kept that. And then also, because the script leaked before they started making it, there was all of those different concerns, so he then decided to not go with the Django sequel. However, he has confirmed that this is in the same cinematic universe as Django. So it takes place in the same... Yeah,
makes sense.
Yeah.
The time and, yes, the whole thing of slavery and all of that.
Yeah. And then the gory special effects were courtesy of The Walking Dead special effects guru Greg... So basically the guy who did the special effects for The Walking Dead in 2010, he did the special effects in this one. And he also did Kill Bill Volume 1, 2, and Django, and Inglourious. So but the gore got to me. Honestly, this one, this time around, I was just like, and also the way they beat Daisy up, like I know she was a murderer but like the violence that they inflicted upon her was a lot. Like, cause they would just punch her out of like, obviously she'd done something and to keep her in like check, they would, but it was hectic, you know, like her teeth were bashed out of her mouth because someone hit her. Like that's a lot. Do you understand? Like it's, so I did feel the violence inflicted.
The first thing that this YouTube video that I watched, which was Everything Wrong with the Hateful Eight, and like go look for this video. It was actually quite interesting. But the first thing that they said on there was that first, when she took the first hits with a gun mm-hmm, on her head, mm-hmm. The fact that after that she like got up and spoke well again, a hit like that would have knocked her out.
Yeah, I think she stayed alive too long. And then she shouldn't have died.
She gets knocked on the nose. And she's licking her blood off her face. I'm like,
yeah, I know. So one of my favorite parts, though, of the film was when Quentin Tarantino narrated the story.
Oh, yes.
That was genius. It was so unique. Literally, you get to a chapter and there's Quentin Tarantino narrating the story at that point, telling you that was so...
I'm glad you did that. For me, that it just gave me confirmation about what exactly is going on.
What's going on,
It just kind of confirmed a lot of stuff that I was like, wait, what's going on? Oh. Okay, great.
Yeah, because I think it is quite a long story. Yeah. Do you know that this film, it's no longer on Netflix. Obviously, Netflix now does that thing where it takes movies down after a while. But it was on Netflix in 2019. But instead of releasing it as a full-length film, what Netflix did, because the movie exceeds 3 hours, released it in 4 episodes, and each episode was about 50 minutes long. So they actually cut the movie into 4 different episodes and then released it like that. But I actually found this quite interesting. So what happened was when Quentin made this film, he filmed it on 65 millimeter film and then would release it on 70 millimeter film. But now obviously all cinemas digitalized, so they don't have like film projectors to show the film off of. But Quentin wanted this film to be released on 70 millimeter. So what he did was, in the old days, he knows about this. In the old days, you'd have something called a roadshow. So when a big movie came out, what would happen is it would be released in certain cinemas. It would have extra time to it, so that you'd have the normal original cuts, and then you'd have the roadshow cuts. And people would get dressed up. There'd be a limited audience. In fact, I think it was an invited audience. So it wasn't just anyone that would watch the movie. Then what they would also have, you'd get a poster. So it was like proper, like almost going to the theater. You'd get a booklet with obviously details on the film. And there was even an intermission. How cool is that? So you'd literally, and some of the actors even record like going to one of these where halfway through the film, there's an intermission. Everyone would go outside, get maybe like refreshments,
restock
but
up
then
on Coke.
Also talk about like what has happened thus far in the film. And then after the intermission, they'd go back in and obviously carry on with the film. And Quentin Tarantino, because of how he wanted the film to be experienced, actually did this. They did a roadshow. So they brought back that old concept of, so it's not like movie premieres that we are accustomed to, where like the cast travels from place to place. This was, the movie was showing in this cinema for this selective time. You had to be invited. It was a longer cut, which most people wouldn't see because they didn't release the, in fact, we didn't watch the 3 hour version. We watched.
Apparently it was on Netflix.
It was. I looked on Netflix. It's not on Netflix anymore. Yeah,
it's not anymore. But when it was, it was the
3 hour version. Yeah. We watched the 2 hour and 47 minute.
Yeah.
So I mean, we missed about 20 minutes of the film. The
it was in between cuts, right? So
there's
probably
.
little things
added, things here and there that then made it the 3 hour version. But how for me it's so, and apparently, because he filmed on the 70 millimeter, there was a special screen. It was like, it was an amazing thing to see. And also, you know, you get those big wide landscape shots that you see in this. The reason for that is because they filmed it the way they did. And Panavision, who had the lenses, it was a whole big, they rebuilt and refurbished cameras for Quentin so that they could film it the way they did. And they even, so because he films on
literally,
actual film,
literally films it.
Yeah, he films it. Mm. They had to, and because Quentin likes long takes. I mean, he has like extended that dialogue and he keeps one camera
like
on
10
you
minute,
for that extended 10 dialogue.
Minute dialogues, yeah.
So that what they did was they actually built bigger magazine.
Yeah.
They're called magazines,
film
right?
Magazines,
film magazines, so that you could get more film on the camera so that you could film the longer takes. So literally they reinvented and refurbished and created cameras and what's the word, like, tweet them.
Only Quentin and Christopher Nolan get those special kind of treatments.
Yeah.
Because those are the two big directors that are still
using,
like,
film.
Doing the film thing and have a lot of respect for film, and they still want to, like, revolutionize the whole film industry.
So for me, what I respect about this film, the storyline was like, honestly, it's not a pretty story at all by any means.
The story's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you're like, I just watched 3 hours
with these guys that got together and a gang, and then they had a slaughter overnight.
And that is the, yeah. So the story is not like anything special, but the acting is insane. The acting honestly is on another level. The whole set in itself, they filmed in very difficult conditions, being that much snow, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that it was set in a snow blizzard, and then the film aspect of it, as in the cameras that they used and what they did to achieve and to film it the way that they filmed it, I think was the amazing part behind the film.
The only satisfying part that I would say out of this film, the only satisfying part is, the fact that the sheriff declined her.
Yes.
So for me, when that happened, I was like, because, I mean, the way that he started off, he was like,
you're like, yo,
I kind of want to hear her sales pitch. Okay. And then he like moves close and he's like, wait, yeah. Then he even looks back, and the angles that was even gotten, like, you see him like considering he's going to, you know, shoot his friend.
No, but then he says, I'm not feeling too well. And really?
Yeah.
And then I don't know if you remember, in the beginning of the film. So Kurt Russell is handcuffed to Jennifer for 5 months. They were literally handcuffed together, because like the whole film, they are handcuffed together because he doesn't want to lose her. So at one point, Samuel L. Jackson, when she spits on the Lincoln letter, he punches her and she goes flying out the wagon. But then Kurt Russell goes flying out the wagon with her because they
cuffed together.
And then he still says something like, it felt like God was shoving off his arm or something like that. But then after he dies, she then cuts his arm off. So, and how is that? You know, when she's hung, you the see her leg hanging, and then you see his arm. And I'm just like, oh my.
About a bloody crime scene, eh?
But then the fact that he fell over, and Samuel L. Jackson is just like, yo, are you still with me? Are you? And then that was, yeah. I think it would have been satisfying if you knew the two of them survived. Mm. I think that would have been a satisfying ending. Yeah,
I was really in my mind trying to put together why they would survive.
There we go.
Just trying to.
I was just like, they died.
But that's it. They're down there. And the saddest part of all is when you see what the place was like before, how much life there was.
Yes.
I'm like,
and it was so nice to see Zoe Bell. So she was in Death Proof. And she was Uma Thurman's stunt double. Mm. And she was in this one.
With her original accent and everything.
Yeah.
Her New Zealand accent.
New Zealand accent.
Yeah.
So, this is a director trademark where a character with a high high off-screen body count. So both General Sandy Smithers and John Ruth, and then also, Kurt Russell's character, both were notorious for having executed and killed many people, but neither of the two kills anyone on screen. Kurt Russell never kills anyone in the film.
No, that's true.
But even though he's known as the hangman, et cetera, et cetera, he never kills anyone on screen.
Sure.
And then this is insane. So I happened upon this video where it said actors who basically cost their boss like an insane amount of money due to a mistake. And Kurt Russell was part of that video, right? I specifically went into it to watch it. So what happened was her character plays guitar and sings, which the song was actually very beautiful. And she didn't know how to play guitar when she originally went to she was supposed to just do like a makeup and screen test. Quentin says to her, do you know how to play guitar? And she's like, no. And then he's like, well, you can learn how to play guitar. I know you're a talented actor and so she literally learns how to play guitar for the film.
Sure.
There was another thing she learned to do, but I'll tell you now. But so she plays the guitar, and then that specific guitar I don't know the names, but it was from a specific guitar museum. Never mind. Like, it was in a museum, right? So it was worth $40,000. And what happened was there was confusion where Kurt, what was supposed to happen was she was playing the guitar.
Kurt wasn't informed.
They were supposed to swap it out with a prop guitar, and then obviously Kurt goes and smashes the guitar against the wall, but he wasn't, there was lack of communication, so he goes and takes the museum's guitar from her and then smashes the guitar to smithereens. And her reaction in the film is her actual reaction, because he wasn't supposed to smash that guitar. So like, her freaking out was actually her freaking out in real life.
Yeah.
After that, so he literally cost them $40,000.
Apparently Tarantino was just standing back going,
like, oh.
He was just like, whoops. Oh, well.
I suppose that's the, he's a nice director. But apparently the head of the museum, the guitar museum, after that said, as a result of the incidents, the company will no longer loan guitars to movies under any circumstance.
Yeah.
So that museum will no longer loan any guitars to any film, anywhere, anytime, any, because Kurt Russell by mistake smashed their $40,000 guitar.
It's an 1870s guitar.
Shit. Apparently Kurt Russell felt so bad that his eyes welled up.
Oh, serious.
That's how. But now imagine, like, how much of a toss must you feel like for going and smashing, and you can't fix it. You cannot fix that. That is not something you can fix. You can't even buy it back. Like, I'm so sorry, can I give you the $40,000? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, you're not getting it back.
And it's not like insurance can just cover it. I mean, it's...
That's why it's in a museum. Yeah. Because there is no other guitar like it.
So it's an antique 1870s Martin guitar. Lent by the Martin Guitar Museum. Yeah.
And they will no longer, the Martin Guitar Museum will no longer.
It says here that Tarantino was in the corner of the room with a funny curl on his lips because he got something out of it with the performance.
Oh, wow. I wonder if he, I feel like he might have ensured Kurt Russell didn't get the message. I feel like this sounds suspicious,
Tarantino.
You know.
Quentin.
So, also Viggo Mortensen was in talks for the character of Jodie, which was played by Channing Tatum, but he had to decline due to scheduling conflicts. And then also Josh Brolin was rumored to have been up for a major role, but nothing.
Josh Brolin, really?
Mm.
Wow.
For those of you who don't know who that is,
my favorite character
Thanos.
in the Marvel. Yeah,
there we go.
MCU.
Thanos is Thanos almost made it into a Quentin Tarantino film, but unfortunately he did not. And then another thing that Jennifer...
Wait. Can we just think about this? Oh, no, wait, but we don't know which character he was going to play. Yeah. It would have been funny if he was like the Hangman, you know, because justice, you know, Thanos.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
For me, it was also funny that he wasn't prepared to kill her. Like, he felt like he needed to work, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, that's what they called him, the Hangman.
The Hangman, because he
wanted to watch them hang. That was the satisfaction of his work.
Yeah, I must be honest. I enjoyed the return of Tim Roth in, because he hadn't been in another Quentin Tarantino film since Reservoir Dogs. Mm. I really enjoyed him. And then Michael Madsen, he's just such a character in a Quentin Tarantino film. So I enjoyed both of them.
It's quite a very specific character.
He does.
Like, just his whole mannerism and the way he's just like.
And the way he talks. He's got such a distinctive voice. So he's got a deep voice.
Yeah.
And then Kurt Russell, it was nice to see again. And obviously Samuel L. Jackson. But then Quentin Tarantino said that Daisy became one of the most interesting characters because she's on the page, but she's not on the page. So she's always there, but she wasn't always like involved in the conversation, but she was always there. Mm. And he said an actress literally needs to invest time in playing that character from beginning to end. They have to get you to the last chapter, because she literally did get you to the last chapter. And it had to be an actress I could trust, and also a performer who you'd enjoy watching her character work. When Jennifer came in, she was very impressive in the reading, but what really got me was I just started watching a bunch of her movies, and he basically had a whole Jennifer Lee Film Festival where he just kept watching her movies one after the other. And he said as he watched one, he couldn't wait to put the next one on because she's such an entertaining actress, especially about the time in the 90s. She acted in a movie called Georgia, also Mrs. Parker and The Vicious Circle. And those movies were built around her, and her performance was the center of the film, and everything was built around that. And that's why he said we needed her for Daisy. And if you think about it, I didn't like her. Mm. I didn't like her the whole film. I didn't like her, but her performance was brilliant. And you know,
I wonder how she is in person.
She's sweet in person.
So she doesn't have that whole southern twang.
She does sort of have a southern twang. But I think she over exaggerated it for the film.
She had like a rasp in her voice.
She did. And she was very. Sure. So Quentin said to her, I want you to spit, but I don't want you to spit like a girl.
Yeah.
Because we all know how girls spit, right? Yeah. Yeah. So he literally said, I wanted to be like a dart. That's like you must aim at a target and you must hit the target. So she literally not only had guitar lessons. I'm not joking. I'm being serious. She had spitting lessons. She literally, because she spat. I don't know if you remember in the film. I was still like, dang, girl, you couldn't spit.
Like more than once. Because
girls don't spit like that. That is not something.
The first one she did was out her nose.
Ah!
Then the second one was the letter.
But she learned how to spit.
In the face.
I didn't know
she
you could.
She spat in the face.
But I didn't know you could learn how to spit.
Like, what is it to learn?
No, Ryan, think about a guy spitting. Have you pictured it? Now imagine a girl spitting. When a girl spits, it just goes everywhere. There's no like, or it just drools down. That's a girl spit. Let's be honest.
So that's to bring someone in. Or did the
she
guys
had to learn how to
I'm
spit.
I'm sure the guys around like, ah, oh, no, come on, come sit here.
No, I think they got someone in. No, but then it's also about directing it, you know?
And make sure that you got enough and make sure it's thick enough. The best thick is from here, so you got to.
And then, no, but she spat like
then,
she did a good job.
And then round your mouth and make sure it comes from the back and not don't. Yeah,
no, but think about it, because like a girl naturally a girl doesn't spit well, right? So when a girl spits well, what does it show you? It's often she's around guys. Do you understand what I'm saying? And she was part of her brother's gang, which I think she was the only female in it. But she really came across as like boyish. Do you understand?
And that's something often seen in westerns, you know.
Yes.
Why now? Why did you go do that now?
Yes, even here when it hits.
It's a very, it's westerns are full of guys.
Westerns, I think, are the most savage people.
It's a natural thing,
cowboys are savages. I know that like you had often cowboys against Indians and the Indians were known as like the savages. But let's be real, people. Cowboys are... They were savage people.
You know what was something to think about is how everyone was walking around with pistols. Like it shows you what the age was like. Like why is everyone walking around with guns? Because they can't trust each other?
Yeah, no.
Because you guaranteed to get robbed on the way. What is it? Why? And did you notice the direction of them? It's so they can grab them like this, like from the front, not
one
from
of,
the back.
One of my favorite moments was after Samuel L. Jackson and the sheriff had been shot, so they're lying on the bed, and then they're telling Channing Tatum to come out from under the basement, so that he's like, throw your gun out! So you see this gun just come out. Then Samuel L. Jackson's like, he probably has a second gun. Tell him to throw the second gun out. So he's like, throw the second gun out. I don't have a second gun. If you don't throw that second gun out, we're going to shoot you in 3 seconds. Second gun goes. And then Samuel L. Jackson's like, I told you I had a gun. And like, out of all of the trauma this film put me through that moment, I actually laughed.
Didn't you wonder why Channing Tatum's character didn't shoot from underneath and kill the other two guys?
Which are the two guys?
So Samuel Jackson and the sheriff.
He did shoot Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, so he shot Samuel Jackson. So why didn't he just shoot the other two from underneath?
Which other two?
So he shoots Samuel Jackson.
Yeah.
Then the whole shootout happens.
In slow-mo.
Then the only two that's left is Samuel Jackson on the bed and the sheriff on a chair. So while he was under there, why didn't he just then wipe out the sheriff?
How big was the basement? Did it cover the whole floor?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
It's a basement.
We do not know the exact measurements of the basement. I don't know.
But that's what I was thinking. I'm like, he's under there. Ooh, they finished. And then they do that. I'm like, oh, okay, cool.
He's dead.
I'm good.
He's all over her face right now.
And then the fact that Samuel Jackson just blew his face off, I'm like, yep, there you go. Like, what are you waiting for? Like, these guys are going to kill you. Why keep them alive? Like, just get him up and just...
The sheriff was brilliant though, because he was,
I liked how he
ripped the Lincoln letter to shreds, which no one had ever questioned before, not even you as the audience.
That was so good.
He ripped it to shreds. And then when she says there's 15 other men, Quentin had set up him already being that person that's able to detect when someone's telling a lie.
Yeah.
And then he ripped that theory too. So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
So this film, that's why I loved it, but I hated it. It was one of those films where you're just like, personally, it doesn't go at the top of my list of Quentin Tarantino films, but I'm glad I watched it. And I respect them for making it.
I won't be watching that film again.
Yeah. You know.
Not even I forget hold of the... Please.
The 3-hour version.
2 hours and 45 minutes. Like I said, the first three quarters was good. Like, I could literally count on my fingers. Okay, there's only been 5 times they've sworn, and there hasn't been anything too hectic.
They actually, last fact, this was very interesting. So, when the first shootout happens, it's at around an hour and 35 minutes into the movie. So, there's no on-screen killing until 1 hour and 35 minutes into the movie. And with the road, remember the road show where they would have intervals? Mm. That apparently, that would screen just before the interval took place. So literally what happened was there was no killing, and just before you would go into the intermission, now suddenly the first on-screen killing took place, and then break. And now you're like, what? And now, okay, fine, let's go get popcorn. And then what's hell? Yeah. So that was cool. I thought that was very...
It's the Avengers cliffhanger.
But you only had to wait 15 minutes, not a whole year, for the second part.
True.
There we go. So we are done with our Quentin Tarantino marathon he brings out his 10th and final film.
Yes.
Which hopefully is a good one.
Yeah. There's a question. So, well, not a question. So, Sashi, what was your top Quentin Tarantino film?
Can I give my top three?
Go for it. Oh, you've got top three.
My top four. Kill Bill, both volumes. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Django and Inglourious. Inglourious might be at the top of that list. Might be at the top.
I think mine is Inglourious and Once Upon a Time.
No, Lord. Pulp Fiction Act 1 and 3 is there as well. Act 2 is not. Mm. Act 2 is at the bottom of the list. Act 2 is at the bottom of the list of Pulp Fiction. Yeah. Let us know what your favorite one is. What your worst one is.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like Quentin Tarantino at all because he's too gory for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this has been the movie show.
Until next week.
We don't know what we're doing, but we will find something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bullet Train.
We are doing Bullet Train next week.
There we go.
It's got Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt. And Channing Tatum.
I like Brad Pitt. Brilliant. Awesome.
Peace.
Until then. And God bless.
All the choices you made, would you make them again?
Like what you're listening to? Of course you
do. Of course you
do. Follow us on all social media platforms and engage with us. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and YouTube. This is Ready On Demand. What you want, when you want it. It's Active FM. Active FM, the Netflix of radio, but better.